No one has looked at the texts that come after Rashiduddin. So these texts in Persian, there's so many texts that no one has ever looked at.
My name is Frances Garrett. I teach at the University of Toronto, and I'm here with our guest, who I'll introduce in a moment, and also some students from a graduate class that I'm teaching this semester on Buddhism and healing. So I'll introduce our dear and esteemed guest, Dr. Ronit Yoeli Tlalim, who teaches at the History Department in Goldsmiths, University of London. So Ronit's research deals with the history of Asian medicine and the transmission of medical knowledge along the so-called Silk Roads. Today, we're here to talk about her new book, just came out recently, called Reorienting Histories of Medicine, Encounters Along the Silk Road. I think we'll start just as a conversation with some questions from our graduate students who are present.
Do you think that there's any trends from back then that could apply to now? Maybe in the sense of like even like hidden reservoirs of knowledge. Essentially, if there's any kind of correlations you could make from back then to the way that knowledge is transmitted today.
So, yeah, first of all, thank you. Thank you, Francis, for inviting me. And thank you for these lovely compliments on the book. So yeah, really interesting question. So first of all, about this question of hidden or lost knowledge, I think there's a lot to say about that that is still relevant for today. At present, I'm especially interested in this whole idea of knowledge that we have lost. So in the West, so when we look at the trajectory of history of medicine in the West, we had a lot of ideas, for example, body-mind connections that we know from Asian medicines that seem to have been lost, that were there in the past, but were kind of kicked out, and now kind of coming back, trickling back as a result of the encounter with Asian ideas. This whole idea of knowledge that is lost and then found again, that I talk about it in the book, I think remains relevant. At the moment, I'm particularly interested in that realm with regards to mental health, because I think there's a lot of lost knowledge, again, in this body-mind connection that we lost in the West, that there is a lot of good reasons to regain, to reclaim, and to bring it back to the mainstream. About this question of the transfer of knowledge and how knowledge moves, and some of the ideas that I talk about in the book that I think are still relevant. So I think in this whole question of what happens when different systems of knowledge come together, what ideas can you take on and what ideas do you reject? And what kind of negotiation, reformulation happens in this meeting point or clashing point? When I started writing the book, I was hoping that I'll get up to the modern time. But I got to the Mongols and thought, okay, I better stop now, otherwise I'll just keep on writing and the book will never finish. But I think there's kind of another book to do, thinking about how these processes are ongoing in terms of what we encounter today in this meeting point between different systems of knowledge.
You mentioned at the end of the section on moxibustion, where you showed all those amazing drawings from old manuscripts of the body. And I wondered, and you mentioned Kuriyama's work just briefly, who Kuriyama talks about different kind of models of the body, comparing like ancient Greek models or more recent European models, and then Chinese or other Asian models of how the body is understood, especially kind of thinking about like the body being generally understood as anatomical, like structured by thinking about the skeleton or the bones, as opposed to maybe the muscles, as opposed to maybe organs or processes of like energies flowing. And I wondered, in your sort of like super extensive sort of looking at these different systems of medical thinking, if you had any insights into that kind of the different ways of cross-cultural ways of looking at the body or thinking of the body.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about Kuriyama and the Kuriyama question. Human bodies are the same everywhere, so how comes there are such different ways of looking at the body or perceiving the body or understanding the body? And I always bring to kind of in the beginning of history of medicine classes these two Kuriyama images that he starts off with. And these are indeed in stark contradiction to what I bring. The images that I bring are about practice. And when we think about, you know, the kind of knowledge that moves easily versus the kind of knowledge that doesn't move, and thinking about the body, so, or images of the body. So the images that I bring and show some, you know, movement and transmission of knowledge is about very practical kind of knowledge and images that are associated with the practical knowledge. So, you know, if you have X problem, burn Y number of moxas in this and that place, and then the arrows, and it's a kind of easy or simple message to bring onto the images of the body without going into the theory behind it. And indeed, somewhere along the path, the practice stays the same, but the theory that explains it, or the underlying theory that explains it, is very different. Whereas the images that Kuriyama bring, they depict two very different philosophical ways of understanding the body. So those are examples of the kind of knowledge that doesn't move. So yeah, when we think about the differences of the imagery, we have a practice-based imagery versus theory-based images. So the theory-based images are very different. The practice-based, we can trace a lineage almost.
Yeah, that as you were talking, I was thinking of like an image of the body that is like an MRI or an ultrasound compared to an image that is an artistic's an artist's drawing of the body, or maybe a like exercise physiologist drawing of the body, which would be, of course, entirely different.
Yeah, just very different approaches to the body that stem from some kind of basic starting point or assumption or artistic or religious or philosophical or cultural point of view that lead to that kind of imagery versus another. So yeah, an artist versus MRI is another example of the two images that Kuriyama brings of the, you know, Vesalius versus the meridians.
I have one question which is very general, but somehow also it's connected to Tibet context, Tibetan texts. As you have extensively dealt and talked about the, especially in chapter 4, you talked a lot on certain Tibetan texts that actually came from Tunghan cave. And you also talked a lot how these texts developed for the first time. And for me, it appears that these texts have emerged as one of more like extensive Buddhist literature that already began in the 10th century. So these texts found that Tunghan, for me, understand that this really challenged the very idea of other Tibetan Buddhist texts, let's say Four Tantra or Juche. That's most of the scholarship believe these texts were found or discovered in 12th century, but your texts, they found in 9th and 10th century, really challenge all these things. So my question is that if you really came across in a certain way that there was already multicultural nature of Tibetan Buddhist texts, or just not forget about the Tibetan, but just say Buddhist texts that were already largely circulating in 9th and 10th century around Tibetan region. So if there was like more or less unique cultural kind of nature of Buddhist texts, because what we see today in Tibetan nature is that all of them were strongly shaped by this, what I mentioned, Four Tantra. So I think your scholarship is really challenging this kind of, you know, narratives.
In my research, I haven't looked so much at the nature of Buddhism in Dunhuang, but more about the nature of medicine, Tibetan medicine in Dunhuang. And we can see that there is evidence for it being multicultural in several ways. So there is the mention of medical systems from elsewhere. So I give, for example, the example of India King, which refers to Khotan. There is the method of the Turks, the Turku. So again, referring to knowledge of a medical system that is a foreign medical system. There is, I don't talk so much about it in the book, but in previous publications, I talk about loan words that come from different languages in the Materia Medica. So loan words that seem to come from Persian or Arabic, different names of places referring to either knowledge or Materia Medica. And this quote that I really like from PT127, that talks about the culmination of the knowledge as coming from different parts. And I see it as a kind of almost an urtext of what we find in later Tibetan medical histories, where we have these narratives, you know, of Galenos and Bhavaradvaja coming. So Galenos coming from the West, Bhavaradvaja coming from India, and the Yellow Emperor coming from China. And this idea that Tibetan medicine is kind of synthesis of different medical knowledges coming from elsewhere and celebrating that. So there is this, I think, really important point to think about when we see narratives like that, is first of all, why are they telling us these stories? And because when we look at medical knowledge in general, in the history of medicine, medical knowledge always moved. In any medical system, you will find influences coming from a lot of different areas, but they're not always celebrated as such. And what's interesting in Tibetan medical history is that we find influences and we find the celebration of it. There is the narrative and the reason behind it. So I'd say it's both multicultural or you know, it's very initial kind of very, it's very basic kind of it's medicine. It's not as developed as we find in the Gyushi. But already in this very kind of basic stuff that we have from Dunhuang, we see that there is already this idea that bringing together different bits of knowledge from different parts or different cultural contexts is something that is to be celebrated and something that is a good thing to do.
So I always thought that that trend in Tibetan medical histories to celebrate the multicultural origins of Tibetan medicine was about going back to the glory of empire and, you know, later on to kind of recall the wonder of the Tibetan empire but you're saying maybe that started even before that time. Can you say more about, like, and I guess if you think also maybe of contrasting it to now, like biomedicine, say, in North America, certainly there's no celebration of the multicultural origins of biomedicine, I would say. It's pretty much like any multicultural like influences are kind of erased, I think, by this like story.
In the book, I mentioned briefly the difference between this kind of celebrating a multicultural kind of medicine versus what we find in the Chinese sources in Dunhuang that are all about this is all Chinese. And that kind of brought me to think about when does a tradition care to acknowledge the different bits that it's building on, and when is it all, oh, it's all Greek or it's all Chinese or it's all biomedicine. There's more work to be done on it. But I think essentially when you have a very dominant, strong tradition, then it just says, oh, it's all Greek, it's all Chinese, it's all biomedicine. But when you have, and the two examples that I talk about in the book, the Tibetan and the Hebrew, they both have this, oh, this came from here and this came from there, and we took that from that culture. And there is position of multiculturalism, and also a position that defines the value so of multiculturalism, but also of the need to translate, so the need to learn from other cultures. And in these two case studies that I talk about in the narrative chapter, looking at the Tibetan case and the Hebrew case, we in both of them, we find this celebrating foreignness and putting value into translation. And it, it is very interesting to look at it, as you say, in connection with the present day and age of the dominance of biomedicine and this shutting down of anything else. What was interesting to note, for example, in the Life of Breath project, where we had clinicians, and okay, so they were open clinicians to begin with, but the point where a dominant culture like biomedicine is willing to open up and say, oh, maybe you guys that study weird things like Tibetan medicine have some ideas for us, is when they come to a dead end. They say in Life of Breath, for example, there is a whole spectrum of cases of unexplained breathlessness. Someone comes to these guys and say, look, I'm breathless. They do all the tests that biomedicine can provide. And they tell them, look, you're fine. And they say, no, I'm not fine. So in this case of hitting a wall, basically, when your tradition can no longer explain what's happening, then you open up. You're desperate. You open up to other kinds of explanation. So this is, I think, it's a really interesting example to think about more generally in history of medicine, where simply the tradition, the dominant tradition, had no longer any explanations to provide. And we see this time and time again. There's some kind of dead end, then there's an opening up to other traditions, other explanations, other models of thinking. In the history of Mark Sebastian, for example, there are examples of this Dutch guy in somewhere in Indonesia, in Sumatra, I think, that had gout and couldn't get treated by anything the Western doctors provided. And then some woman did some Mark Sebastian on him. I think it was 17th century. She did some Mark Sebastian on him and that treated the gout. And then he started writing about Mark Sebastian. And then, you know, Westerners were suddenly interested in Mark Sebastian. It's these points where a dominant tradition opens up to other explanations. It's yet to be seen how COVID will change our ways of thinking. And I think we started exploring the question in this Asian medicine and COVID-19 special issue that I did with Michael Stanley Baker. But there is definitely more to think about.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point to think about how these things change over history, of course, because I wonder if you had kept going with your research into the present day, if you would have found that to be really transformed, at least in the case of Tibetan medicine. Because if you think of Tibetan medicine, maybe in the time that you're looking at it, it's not a dominant tradition. And so maybe, like you're saying, it needs to kind of take in other traditional other models and celebrate that. But then on the other hand, like later in history, Tibetan medicine does become a dominant system in the Himalayan region, and to the extent of even like shutting down other local Himalayan traditions of healing. I mean, I guess that's kind of your point about the center and periphery kind of thing, is that sometimes a tradition is at the center and sometimes it's on the periphery, and that keeps like shifting, and it shifts, of course, in relation to other entities around it.
Yeah, it's definitely not a static thing.
So Jade says, regarding the Mark Sebastian charts with illustrations of the body, I noticed how one of them you mentioned that the depiction of a woman is very rare. I'm wondering if you've noticed strong cross-cultural affirmation of the gender binary or biological essentialism, especially when it comes to texts you mentioned that are more focused on practical use. Also curious about what the lack of female representation suggests about other potential gaps in knowledge.
These images of the body are very rare. So we don't have a lot. I mean, there are a few more in the Chinese context, but one point I was trying to make is that these are some of the earliest images of the body that we have. And in these very early images of the body, the very few that we have, even fewer and rare are images of women. There is, if we're talking about visual images of the body, there is perhaps the next step in or the next phase in history are what are known as the five images that are seem to come from Islamic medicine, where we have a set of five images of the human body, and each of them depicting a system of, so one of them is the blood system, one of them is somehow representing the digestive system, and then at some point there is a sixth image added to these, and that is an image of a woman, a pregnant woman. So in terms of images of the body or the early history of images of the body, images of women are very rare. And when we have them, they're often about pregnancy. So you ask about the gender binary. I would say that, you know, looking at gender binary question, which is a really interesting one, I haven't seen kind of questioning of the gender binary issue in these very early images. We do find them in texts. You know, Janet Gyatso has written quite a lot about the third gender in Tibetan, in Jewish, from sources from very early on. There is discussion about 8 or 9 genders. So there's this question of gender binary come up a lot more in text than in these images that are very crude. So our dominant system today, biomedicine, you know, knows how to, it's very advanced, is, you know, is wonderful in a lot of things, but it also is lacking in a lot of things. And I think certainly in mental health, there is a lot of lost knowledge or knowledge that exists in other traditions that awaits to come into the mainstream. And just like I mentioned with regards to unexplained breathlessness, it's when one way or another the system or a person or a physician hits a dead end that it becomes open to accepting other ideas, other systems of knowledge, other approaches to looking at how the body and mind are connected. Essentially, in the West, the body and the mind were separated for a very long time. Now there's more approaches that say, oh, maybe they are connected. Of course, anyone who's any interest in Buddhism and in systems that are of health that are derived from Buddhism, the link seems so obvious and so misrepresented in the way that biomedicine looks at mental health that I think there is much to do to bring them together. Yeah, and I think the kind of work that has been done in the last few decades in the Mind and Life Institute that tries to link these different approaches is really important and is changing a lot of ways that biomedicine is looking at this question. Again, from the 14th Dalai Lama, realizing that in order to make a contribution, if we look again in these categories of main system and subsidiary system, the subsidiary system can make a contribution if it talks in the language of the main system. So this is why, you know, the Dalai Lama said in the beginning of my life, he said, okay, we've explored the mind for 2,500 years. We have a lot to offer the West, but we have to offer it to the West in the language of science, because this is the language that they would accept. So once they started measuring, meditating people with electrodes and saw, oh, it's good for this and this, and we can see it in our MRI. This is how the breakthrough of things like mindfulness into mainstream therapy was able to happen. And so similarly, I think if the mental health contributions that come from Asian medicine can make their way into mainstream, if they follow the same kind of path.
if you could say something about quote unquote Buddhist healing in a modern context as a whole. And I kind of want to add to that, you know, maybe in the context of Pierce Salguero's questioning about the term Buddhist healing or Buddhist medicine, and whether just if you have a thought about the use of that kind of term.
How do we understand the word healing?
I feel like somewhere in your, I forget where, but in your book, you kind of talked about therapy. I guess therapy is kind of the practical application. What is medicine? You know, is it a substance that's plant derived, or is it words that I've offered somebody or whatever?
Maybe the point is that we need to think about medicine, therapy, healing happening at a lot of different levels. There is the biological level. So it's, yeah, if it's a substance that we somehow digest or whatever comes into our body, there's a level of, let's say, the words of whoever is treating. There's the level I mentioned at one point that Mark Geller, whose field is Babylonian medicine, talks about this false dichotomy between magic and medicine, and this idea that we know that a lot of healing happens in our head, but we have to create the conditions that this kind of healing will happen. And here, there are different cultural conditions and situations that create healing. So these are culturally based kind of healing. So for a typical Westerner, going into a hospital and talking to someone with a white gown or creates kind of ease and calm that the person who's gone through the system knows what he's doing, has the capacity, has the tools, has the blood tests, et cetera, to give me the best that modern medicine can do. And in another cultural context, it can be that some spiritual healer or whatever is capable of doing that. But in any case, there is this idea that we need to think about, and things like placebo studies have shown this really deeply, how we need to think of healing as happening in all these levels at the same time, or maybe happening at a few levels and not happening in another, and that may be somehow blocking the healing process. In the Buddhist context, I think someone within a Buddhist milieu would adhere to, would follow, would be prone to be healed at these different levels at the same time. So both whatever one would digest, but also the spiritual advice and practice advice and the livelihood advice and all these different aspects of human life, of well-being, that are all part of, potentially a part of well-being and healing. And similarly, we have in other religious contexts, we have the same. So a real belief in the power of prayer to make a difference, which ultimately can make a difference because it operates something in the mind of the person who needs to be healed. And that in itself has power. There's a fascinating short clip by Ted Kupchuk, who does placebo studies in Harvard Medical School. He comes from Chinese medicine, but he's now in quite a big name, placebo studies. He talks about how in the beginning, when he was doing Chinese medicine, people would say to him, oh, it's just a placebo. But with what we know about placebo studies now, it's not just a placebo. If it's a placebo, it often is in itself healing.
That's so valuable in your book. I really love how you use also Tim Ingold in that section on forgetting about chemistry. And then when you're thinking about the material, the meaning of materials, as you say, and instead looking at these like material flows and processes as part of the substances that you might be talking about. As I was reading that section, I was also thinking about the concept of terroir in food studies, so that where we think of, like in terms of understanding wine, like where does a fine wine come? It comes from the soil of a certain part of France or something. So this is theory about the cultural, that a place itself holds this healing power, or that holds this like power of taste. And so that's kind of what came to my mind, this concept that is like connects scientific, literary, political, and economic commentaries about celebrating taste, the physiology of taste, but also the culture of taste. Mm-hmm. In terms of wine, but then also in terms of food studies or foods more generally, like we love the oranges from Southern California or something, even though they may taste the same as such and such other orange. And so it's like the taste of the region, not just the taste of the thing that you're eating. And so then I was just wondering if this is something that came to your mind also as these materials are traveling, like part of their value. It's a fruit from India and it has everything to do with India in, you know, the power of that fruit.
Yeah, and that's why I kind of went back and forth into this idea of India as the place of magical or really special stuff that would cure you. And this idea, connected idea, that people in India live a long life. Mm-hmm. And these stories that keep coming in so many variations and so many cultural context, and the secret to immortality is somewhere in the East. And oh, and here's something from the East. Why don't you have it and cure whatever you have? I think these things mesh together. This idea that, you know, oh, I brought this from very far away. It traveled all the way from the East, where all these stories of long life, immortality, etc., etc. So I think they mesh together. And they create value, not just money value, but they create value in the efficacy as well. So
yeah.
So that's why we need to think of these special substances in all these different levels.
I really like the literature on terroir because it also then it takes that kind of idea, but all connects it to the land and the relationship of people to the land and to nature and to the soil. And I think that kind of adds a neat dimension to it.
Hmm. Indeed, this issue of taste and the geography of taste and the link between geography, taste, and value with relation to foods, and especially to special foods.
Yeah, because I think medicines are foods. I mean, it's a culinary issue, especially if you're thinking of Tibetan medicine, but other kinds of similar traditions where like the preparations are written out as recipes and it's a combination. You don't take just one. You don't just eat the one fruit or the one medicine. You take like this combination of a whole bunch of them and you follow practices. It's like cooking, basically, where you're following these instructions and preparing the meals, the medicinal meals, really. There's a lot of interesting sort of comparisons with food studies, medicinal preparations as recipes and that kind of thing.
And that is relational in the West. These things from India are special, but equally we have these stories in Chinese medicine about stuff that's coming from the Islamic world that is very special. So yeah, the exotica of stuff combines a lot of different aspects. With Rashida Dean, I think there's a lot of really huge open questions that are still there. So we know about this, the Tansuknamé, the translation, adaptation, whatever, into Persian of Chinese medicine. There is still a huge open question about the impact of that. Was it just, you know, that single text that was done there in Tabriz and, you know, under special conditions and so on? Was that the end of the story, or did that somehow trickle in, made an impact or not? Persis Berlikamp, for example, who studied the images of this book, has said, you know, it's a unicorn, one manuscript, no impact, end of story, nothing to think about. But I remember discussing this with Fabrizio Speciale, who looks at connections between Islamic medicine and Ayurvedic medicine in India. So I asked him what he thought about this question. And he said, and this is something really important to remember, he said, we have no way of knowing because no one has looked at the texts that come after Rashiduddin. So these texts in Persian, there's so many texts that no one has ever looked at. Furthermore, so I have a colleague in my department, Bruno De Nicola, who has a huge project now, just mapping these texts, just saying, okay, in this library in Tehran, we have 5,000 texts, 400 of them are on medicine, and they come from those centuries. Like even this basic thing is now done for the first time. We have to realize that we have no way of knowing. We know what we know, but we have to know why we don't know what we don't know. So we don't know the impact of that kind of text. Yes, it's true, it's only one manuscript, but there could have been adaptations, there could have been some kind of variation, say, of the imagery. Because it's such a different system, bringing Chinese medicine into Tabriz of the Mongol era, you know, it won't fly easily. But there could be some trickling, some rethinking. And this is something, for example, that Vivian Lowe has suggested, that it slowly brought to a rethinking that ultimately led to the idea of Harvey, of the blood circulation. So in the way that Rashiduddin doesn't know what to do with the word qi and simply translates it as blood. And so there is the beginning of an idea that the blood flows somehow. It doesn't say circulate, but there is some kind of flowing that is equivalent to qi flowing that ultimately brings to the idea that there is blood circulation. So there's all these ways of trickling ideas, influencing in subtle ways that we simply just don't know yet.
That's so amazing. And really, I encourage anyone who has the time and the youth to learn Persian and also Tibetan and also some of the other languages that you are able to use in your research, because there's so much exciting, you know, material to be learned from that. Part of what I find so exciting about your research is that you can read in all of these different languages, and that's so rare. So that's so rare and allows you to really see the kind of, you know, very few people could have written the book that you wrote that we were talking about today. And so it really allows you to access this kind of larger global perspective on the kind of Eurasian transmission of information knowledge, which is like super exciting. I think this is one of the most exciting books I've read in a long time. Thank you so much for coming to visit us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, and happy that you enjoyed the book. Thank you for inviting me.